From the climate models that have been built to represent the complexity of the climate system around the world and used in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, this is not the kind of model that Ron was talking about. There are 23 of these used in the IPCC report. The CSIRO and Bureau of Meteorology have used those, and for this could be done for any country in the world, try to use this as the basis of trying to get the best view of what is likely to happen in the Australian region. And this information is available on the web now. It was published only about 2 or 3 weeks ago. What it tells us is that by 2030, we're expecting rainfall decreases across the whole of the continent, virtually. And it also tells us that if we look at evapotranspiration, or the loss of water, primarily because of the higher temperatures, we're expecting increases of that. What that does is it is changing the normal balance. That is, we normally have so much rainfall at a particular location, and then we have about this amount of evaporation. And the difference between those is the water that we have available. So it's the difference between two relatively large numbers. We shift one of them, or in this case, both of them a little bit, we have significant changes in available water. That means for Australia, for our agriculture, for our land, our natural ecosystems, for our potable water use, for our power generation. In all of these cases, the prognosis looks for a drier Australian continent. Now, rather than try to give you a comprehensive review of this, I just want to take, for example, how do you assess that in terms of, say, agriculture in the Australian region? And I'm trying to demonstrate here that actually it's very difficult. And so it's very difficult to actually weigh how important it is to stop these things happening. And unless you can, well, then do you know how much you're prepared to pay? But for example, in this case, in Australia right at the moment, because we're in a drought, we have a trade-off starting to begin between the use of land for water capture, for fibre production, food production, biofuels, and potable water, and the survival of ecosystems. In Melbourne, for example, right at the moment, there's a big argument going on about the removal of water to keep Melbourne surviving until they can build the desalination plant, and that's going to come from the ecosystems. So we are entering a phase where this balance will have to be a very proactive discussion. But of course, if we lose capacity of individual ecosystems, productive capacity of natural ecosystems, then there are services that those ecosystems provide. And we need to understand whether this is important or not. It's not just whether we lose species, it's whether we lose services from those species. And there's threats to infrastructure within the rural sector when we change storminess, hail frequency and inundation in some areas. And there is changes globally, because while Australia experiences this change, China may experience a different change, or a change that actually compounds or interacts with our changes. We need to understand that, because it may open up opportunities, or it may reflect threats that we didn't anticipate. And finally, as Ron has pointed out in his slide, in order to change the emissions globally, we have to change the energy system quite dramatically. And there will be winners and losers out of this, and in our case, for example, in the Australian community, it takes at least about a third of all of the energy that is in a crop when it leaves the farm gate in fuel used on the farm. So if fuel prices change, it's significant, or if you want to use that biomass for biofuels, it's a factor you have to consider. So what about energy futures? Well, Ron has showed the diagram, which is effectively what is called the wedges diagram, where we have a series of options trying to fill in where we would be to meet the energy demand of the world, which we all want to do, but where we have to be in order to slow or stop the change in climate. And there's a fundamental piece of information. Ron talked about the fact that it's the oceans and the capacity of the oceans to move carbon from the surface to the deep that is actually the limitation. It's a physical limitation. It's something we can't do anything about, although we can change it as we change the climate. We know that currently that's roughly about 2,000 million tonnes of carbon a year, and we're currently emitting more like 8,000 million tonnes of carbon. So when people talk about targets, they often don't understand, but that's a physical reality, and that's the reason for this first dot point. It's a dot point I have to make because there are people who don't understand that it's the physical world that actually ultimately constrains what we can put into the atmosphere if we want to stabilise the climate. The other two points I'm going to skip because I don't have enough time. The other point with regard to energy is really to follow on from the kind of modelling that Ron has talked about. That is the conjunction between physical science, social science and economics. And this is really to implore any discussion that might occur in the later presentation today about alternative energy sources, that we need to look at it from that perspective. The 20th century was when we used to actually think from an engineering point of view about this piece of technology solving our problems. In the 21st century, we've got to do better than that, because it is the interaction between social issues, environmental and physical issues around the real world, as well as the economics, that we have to actually try to balance. So that when you look at any of the options that Ron pointed out, and there are others, of course, then there are issues around how the cost will unfold, and in most cases we don't know exactly how that will happen. In some cases there are still technical feasibility issues. In most cases there are issues around how quickly you can actually build the alternative energy resource, and we don't, as I'll show in a moment, have a lot of time to respond. So there are issues around timing as well, and there are social issues around acceptability of the options. This is what we call loosely sustainability science. It's moving our science into a new generation where we have the capacity of bridging the gap between physical, natural sciences, economics and social science in order to give much more useful guidance to policy development in both the private and public sector. So managing risk. This slide will probably, I think, I'm not certain, come out on Saturday in the IPCC synthesis report. I'm not doing anything bad because IPCC actually has this available on their website. But I just want to point out to you that in this table, their IPCC has looked at six alternative scenarios into the future, that is with different CO2 emissions and the combined effects of carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide and other gases, and then looked at the temperature change and the sea level change associated with that. Now the first point, of course, is the one that Ron mentioned, and that is that there's a debate, a clear debate about what is dangerous. How far do we want to go before we actually claim that it's dangerous? And that debate is at the moment in two spheres. Scientifically, a lot of our colleagues are arguing that it's actually less than 2 degrees. In the reality, the European Union has a target of 2 degrees. And I think most people in the science community would feel that 3 degrees is definitely nudging, for the sorts of reasons that Ron's mentioned, the danger barrier. And what does that mean? It means that of these six scenarios that the IPCC examined, only one of them gets us to 2 degrees. And that one is the one that actually sets targets of about 450-500 parts per million change. And that's, as it says, that we actually have to peak our emissions as a global community sometime between the year 2000 and 2015. We're there. It's not something for the future. We're in it. We don't have a lot of time, and it means rather significant reductions by 2050. What else could be wrong with our interpretation of the risk associated with this? Well, we could be underestimating how fast things are going. This diagram indicates the IPCC projections for temperature and sea level rise that were made in 2001, and the red line is what actually happened. We certainly got it a bit underestimated in that last round. So it could happen again. The science isn't perfect. It refers to what Ron mentioned, the sea ice extent in the Arctic. It's been going down last 10 years. It decreased by about 10%. As Ron's pointed out, this year was particularly low. That's what that red dot at the end says. Now, when we all saw this, I was in this building only 3 weeks ago with a group of international experts where there was a paper given on this, and for the first time I've ever seen a set of scientists looking at these data and being concerned. We don't want that sea ice extent to be down there again next year, because it could start to indicate that this is a non-linear response to a change that we don't want. And it can have other ramifications other than simply moving ice and the walruses and polar bears. This is actually data that came out only in the last few weeks, indicating the capacity of the ocean to take up the 2,000 million tonnes that it currently takes up. And for the 25 years or so that I've been involved in this field, we've known that this is going to happen. But I think we're all surprised to find that there's evidence that is already happening. The oceans are losing their capacity to take up carbon. That could mean that, in fact, we're underestimating how quickly things will change into the future. This is a picture of what we've done in terms of emissions. The black dots are a history of what we've done, and what it shows is that in 2006, despite the rhetoric and the actions of governments all over the world, it was the highest emissions ever, and the CO2 increased in the atmosphere faster than ever in 2006. The green and blue lines are IPCC scenarios that attempt to stabilise the climate somewhere in the region of 2 or 3 degrees change, or at least that amount of change through this century. The red line is close for the next few decades, at least, to a business as usual. That's where we're tracking. We have to break that nexus if we're going to get this under control. And then there are other issues around equity, which I happen to think personally are the biggest issues that we haven't faced up to at all. And this diagram just simply says a number of modelling groups have tried to estimate the number of people in the world stressed in water stress companies that are countries that are have increased water scarcity by 2025 or 2050. It's important to realise these number in the hundreds of millions of people. Now, what does that mean in a world in which we try to do what the chairman said, and that is to address this thing, this problem, in a concerted way and in a shared way, in a congenial way across the various borders of the various countries in the world? So in conclusion, climate change is with us right now. In this country, we've seen reports recently about it being on the radar screen. I think it's the wrong analogy. A radar is used when something's in the different distance and you can't quite see it. We only have to look out the window and we can see it now. We're there. Climate change is happening, and it's already impacting on people.